studying with Rabbi Eliezer, and he had learned from me. He knew what a great teacher he was, and how amazing his teachings were. And even after that, when Rabbi Eliezer was excommunicated, he still didn't go to see Rabbi Eliezer until he met with the rest of these people. So he was the only one who had ever asked Rabbi Eliezer one of these questions. He knew all these teachings and how great he was, but he still hadn't left. So that's why maybe his death would be.
Sure. Also, in terms of Rabbi Akiva's question, we talked about whether Rabbi Eliezer was seeing that as a good thing or a bad thing. Also, in terms of, he said, I have all of this knowledge. So we said it could either be, I have all of this knowledge, how dare someone ask me a question, in terms of like the arrogance that we see in the Tanorach Nai story, or I know 300 halachot on this one leper spot. It's such a narrow line of work that nobody cares, and everyone's really bored by my, you know, line of expertise.
We discussed a sort of circularity.
So can people hear each other? Yes.
In Rabbi Eliezer's life, that he was excommunicated basically over an issue of Torah in the Tanur Shalat Nai. It was a debate over the purity of an oven, and then he dies sort of getting it right. He, on a different issue of purity, and his last word is tahor, and it says that he died in purity.
Okay, and when you say getting it right, you mean?
Well, they agree with these same rabbis who he was disputing with now seem to agree with him, probably. It just sort of seems like a very full circle.
I thought it was interesting how Rabbi Akiva was hitting himself until the blood came out, and that kind of parallels the way that he actually died with the Romans flaying his skin, but to a different degree of magnitude. That's interesting also because the other bits of the story were about differing degrees of magnitude between what the teacher knew and what the student knew. I'm not sure exactly how the parallel works, but it's interesting.
We were also interested in how come he died right after he says "Utahor" and the Atzani Shmato Pitahara, as if like he said the right words and then it was okay. It didn't happen the question before, but it happened exactly at that point.
We wondered how the first part of the story with the sun and the tefillin fit into the rest of the one of the things we wondered about was when Rabbi Eliezer says, I'd be surprised if you all had a natural death, and then he tells Rabbi Akiva his death would be worst of all. And kind of like in the Agada we learned a few days ago, where a rabbi causes the death of his son-in-law by assuming that he's already dead, but because he's already spoken these words, the event has to take place even though it didn't necessarily need to otherwise. So are Rabbi Eliezer's words in this instance, are they prophetic, are they just an angry rant, or is it somehow positive?
So we were also, we were wondering a lot of the same things all the groups have been wondering, but one of the things we spent a lot of time discussing was the triviality of the things he seemed to be studying. We proposed a few different answers, perhaps that he was studying things that were very trivial, but doing them in such magical and great ways, and therefore it shows his greatness, and like had he been studying other things, it would have been even greater. But another thing we proposed is that connecting to the beginning of the story where he yells at his son for focusing on trivial things, maybe he's mad at himself for only focusing on trivial things and not being needed.
One of the things that just occurred to us was that maybe Rabbi Akiva, having learned this from Rabbi Yehoshua, under the auspices of this particular thing about Kishuim under witchcraft, is maybe a direct attack on Eliezer.
Because Rabbi Eliezer actually does it.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
We were wondering about the metaphor that Rabbi Akiva uses at the end, and whether he's referring to his teacher's death or to his knowledge of his own inevitable painful end.
We were wondering if there was any connection between.
Can you speak up?
We were wondering if there was any connection between what Rabbi Akiva that it's doing at the end, and what he says at the end, and with fate that Rabbi Eliezer spells out for him at the beginning of the story.
In terms of the tearing his flesh, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's similar to what
they did.
And we were also wondering why cucumbers specifically.
Yeah, and I heard that question come up elsewhere as well. Well, okay, so we're not going to address all these questions, but a lot of them cluster around certain things that that will certainly come into the discussion here. I wanted to start by focusing on the halachic questions, right, that the visitors ask, you know, Rabbi Eliezer at that moment, you know, just before his death, and several of you talked about that, and we can sort of there's kind of a bunch of ways we could look at them. One is to kind of look at them globally, in other words, not at each specific one, but at sort of what's the topic, what kind of halacha they're asking him about. And a couple of you mentioned that it is striking that the questions that they're asking him are of the kind which led to his excommunication to start with, right? Which table made that point? You guys made that point. That's right. In other words, the argument, right, the dispute which leads to the fateful excommunication in the Tanur Shalchanai story is a dispute about the susceptibility, right, of a particular kind of object, in that case of an oven, the susceptibility of that object to impurity. The sages and Rabbi Eliezer have a dispute about that, which ultimately leads to the excommunication. And here, right, it's kind of ominous. I always kind of think if this were a movie, right, a scene in a movie and there were music, you know, I always feel that as you get to the fourth paragraph, you know, that music would sort of become more ominous, right? Well, here they are, right, back where this whole thing started, right, asking him questions about purity and impurity. Rashi actually says something extremely interesting about this, and you don't have the Rashi, I'll read it to you. And all the commentators have a problem with what Rashi says. It's kind of a technical problem, so I'm not going to bother discussing what the problem is. But Rashi, whether he's right or not in terms of the technicalities, offers, I think, a very interesting insight. And he says like this. He says, "Lefi shenechleku be'elu, Rabbi Eliezer v'chachamim, b'seder tahavot," because Rabbi Eliezer and Chachamim, and the sages disputed these laws, right, in Seder Taharot, the part of the Mishnah that talks about purity and impurity. And Chachamim say these things are not susceptible to impurity, right? And Rabbi Eliezer says they are susceptible to impurity. Because of that, he says, Bishat Ptirato Hayurotzim Leda Im Chazarbo. Right, at the moment that he was about to die, they wanted to know whether he had changed his mind. V'shaluhu ma'atomer v'otan hamachloktot. And so they said, well, what do you now say about those matters of dispute? Okay, so Rashi is seeing the purpose of the sages' questions as trying to ascertain, has Rabbi Eliezer retracted his position on the kinds of matters, right, which we've been disagreeing about for the past, who knows how many years. Now, I don't necessarily feel like Rashi does, that that's the motivation of the sages asking the question. But I do think that in terms of the audience, which means us, right, in terms of how we hear these questions, that's a very important point. In other words, Rashi is saying we have to hear these questions, right, with the backdrop of the fact that these questions were at the crux of what alienated Rabbi Eliezer from the rabbinic community to start. And we'll get back to that point a bit later. Another thing in this sort of conversation in the fourth paragraph is the following. Okay? First, they ask him about these five objects: kadur, imus, kaviyatzur, hamagaliot, umashkolek, tana. And he says, right, they are tmein, right? They're susceptible to impurity, or literally, they're impure, and they can become purified just as they are. Right, which seems like just a sort of halachic statement. But when they ask the next question, what about the shoe on the last? And on the fourth line of that paragraph, he says, hu tahor. And on the fifth line of the paragraph, the narrator steps in and says, v'yatza nishmato b'tahara, his spirit, his breath, left him in purity. then all of a sudden the words pure and impure in the story take on a completely different meaning. Right? Rabbi Eliezer and the sages might be having a conversation about a technical halachic matter, albeit one that's very resonant, right, in their past, as Rashi points out. But the words pure and impure, right, when they're first asking it, might just mean, so technically pure or impure. But in the context of the story, and the story foregrounds this for us at this moment, right, pure and impure, or at least this last statement, hu tahor, is taken by the narrative as a reflection on the status of Rabbi Eliezer himself. And presumably, in the last line of that paragraph, it's not just the narrator who is letting us in on that, but the characters themselves in the story recognize that, right? Because when Rabbi Yeshua stands on his feet and says, Hutar Haneder, Hutar Haneder, again, as I mentioned before, there's two ways you can read that. Right? One is that Rabbi Yeshua stands on his feet at that moment and he says, I'm lifting the excommunication. Right? And it's Hutar Haneder as what we call a performative statement, right? I declare the excommunication as being annulled. That's one possibility. A very safe thing to do after somebody dies, by the way. I don't mean that humorously. We see this many times in our own lifetimes, in our own communities, that a figure who has a lot to offer but is also very problematic, often after their death, can be sort of re-accepted by the community in a way that in that person's lifetime they couldn't be. So that's one possible meaning here, right, that Rabbi Yeshua at this moment is declaring the excommunication to be annulled. Another possibility is a little different. Not that he's declaring to be annulled, but that he's reflecting on the fact that hearing that Rabbi Eliezer's dying word is tahor, he takes it as an indication that the excommunication has kind of evaporated. Right? He takes that as a kind of sign, right, a divine sign or a human, some sort of a sign, right, that reflects the fact that Rabbi Eliezer is no longer in a state of alienation from the rabbinic community. In either event, right, what I want to point out is that once we have the statement, Hu tahor v'yatzah nishmat tov v'tahara, once the narrative reflects on the fact that the word tahor is not merely a technical halakhic statement here, right, but is a reflection on the status of Rabbi Eliezer himself, what I want to suggest is that we can read that hermeneutic back into the earlier part of that paragraph, right? When they ask him about the status of these five objects, and he says, "Kain tmein," right? They are impure. "V'tavatan b'mashen," right? They are impure, but they can become pure just as they are. And I want to suggest that we could read those words also as talking about Rabbi Eliezer himself, in which case, right, what he's saying is, well, I am in a state of tum'ah, a state of rejection from you, but I can become pure just as I am. And what I think is striking about that is that, of course, on the next line, right, he does get declared pure just as he is. And the just as he is, I think, is a very important part of this. Because one thing that we see in this story is that Rabbi Eliezer hasn't changed one little bit. Right? Rabbi Eliezer, as you all noticed in the earlier parts of the story, the first paragraph, the second paragraph, he's a very harsh person. In the first paragraph, he criticizes, insults, and yells at his son and his wife. In the second paragraph, he either prognosticates or, as somebody said, perhaps puts into action a terrible fate for his students, and in particular for his most special student, Rabbi Akiva. Right, and we see Rabbi Eliezer acting this way all over the shops. Right? This is the kind of person he is. He's a guy like, somebody asks him a question the wrong way, the guy's going to die within a week, right? He's the guy that doesn't let some of us, that would include myself, learn Torah. Okay? He's not the most welcoming person. And as we know from the Tanur Shalach Meister, he's a guy who sticks with his opinion. And again, Rashi's insight that maybe they're coming to find out, did you still stick with your opinion? Again, I don't know if they're coming to find that out, but one thing we find out is he, in fact, has stuck with his opinions. This is not a guy who simply, flows in the wind because that's what's going to be more palatable to others. Just one second. So what I'm trying to say is that perhaps the words, Hein Tzmein V'Tarvatan B'Mashahin, is a reflection on myself, on Rabbi Eliezer, right? I am impure. You've declared me impure, guys. If Tahor means I'm not excommunicated, right, then impure means I am excommunicated. You've declared me impure, but I'm telling you that I'm going to end up, I can become pure just as I am. Yeah, Itamar.
Yeah, just are those five specific things that they have argued about?
You mean, do we have attested that they've argued about that before?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a great question. So Rashi says, right, we know that in Sefer Taharot they've argued about these things. The fact is, and in a minute I'll give a handout for those who are interested, I've collected all the places these objects come up, as all the commentators after Rashi point out, most of these things are not attested as subjects of dispute in Sefer Taharot. One of the five is, which is, I think, what Rashi's picking up on. I don't think he's really saying all five were. I think he's saying, well, you know, some of them are, and no doubt probably the others were, right? And so there is a tradition of about at least one of those five things that it was a subject of dispute. And the opinions are exactly, correspond to Rabbi Leizer's opinion here. He says, it's tameh. Now, what these objects are and whether or not these objects, the nature of these objects is significant, we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. Okay? I want to point to something else, which is, I said before that if you kind of imagine this as a movie, I think the music would kind of get very ominous as they start asking these questions. Right? By the way, why are they asking these questions? I mean, why are they asking these questions? I don't know what I remember. Why are they asking questions at all, do you think, at this point? Yeah?
You just finished complaining about no one ever asked him.
Okay, so that's one possibility, right? They're responding to the fact that he complained nobody ever asked him questions. Any other thoughts? Yeah?
Well, they'd be scared of his threat that they're going to die unnatural deaths.
So they want to somehow redress the fact that he's criticized them in this way and that might lead to a bad fate? Is it?
I guess so, or maybe they're taking him seriously because they're concerned about that.
Okay, yeah?
This could be like their last chance to learn with him.
Last chance to learn with him, yeah?
Could be a way to honor him.
Okay. Yeah?
It could also be that he was like the master of Tyra.
But then why haven't they come up till now? Okay, so that's a kind of an interesting thing, right? All of a sudden, as he's about to die, they start asking him all these questions, right? For one of several of the reasons that you folks mentioned, right? But the fact of the matter is, right, it's not the case that you can't learn Torah from someone who's been excommunicated. So that's actually, I think, a very important aspect of this story, right, that whereas he's been in excommunication, right, and again, we find out, I think, shockingly at the beginning of the story that excommunication was never lifted. We might have imagined that 30 days later they would have lifted the excommunication or something, right? We find out that maybe 30 years later he's still in excommunication, but we actually find out more than that at the beginning of the story, which is not only that they've sort of kept to the rules of excommunication, but that excommunication has manifested or has resulted, right, in a total casting out of him to the degree that actually they haven't come till now, right? All of a sudden now they want to know these things, maybe because he reminded them that he has so much to teach. Okay, but if, right, they had forgotten that, right, they had not had access to his Torah. Now, in fact, when he says to them, and I'm sort of, this is a little parenthetical because we're in the middle of the fourth paragraph, but going back to the second paragraph, when he says, Lama Batim, why have you come? Why have they come? I'm hearing silence. Why have they come? You say, Bikur Cholim, you say?
Maybe because Rabbi Akiva asked them to.
Maybe because Rabbi Akiva asked them to, but he hasn't come up until now.
And he seems to be the only person who cares all that much.
Okay, so why is he coming now?
Guilt.
Okay. Yeah?
I assumed it was like larger political events. Something is happening in the outside world and they need to talk to him to get his advice.
Okay. Who should we vote for? No. Okay. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah?
I mean, it's easy for them to take him for granted when, you know, they know he's going to be around for a while, but all of a sudden this idea of mortality and his knowledge, whatever he's got left to share, has become this precious commodity, and so they want to soak it up while they can.
Okay, yeah.
And maybe to see if some kind of reconciliation is possible.
Okay, yeah.
Not sure they're entirely sure why they're there.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe they didn't come to learn Torah, maybe they came for something else, and the fact that they didn't tell him the real reason why they came is why he liked them.
Okay, so this is interesting, because I think seven of you spoke, I wasn't counting, but it strikes me that it was seven, and only one of you said that they came to, I think it was you, right? What's your name?
Lily.
Sir?
Lily.
Lily. say, well, they're coming to learn Torah now because they realize he's about to pass on, and it's their only opportunity. The other six of you did not say that he came to learn Torah. And other thoughts, including maybe we don't know why they came. The simplest thought is, you know, what Benji said, right? The Talmud is full of deathbed scenes where somebody is dying, a sage. In fact, there's two stories later in Masechta Sanhedrin about Rabbi Eliezer's deathbed and people coming to visit him. So the idea of coming to visit somebody in their deathbed is not at all an unusual thing. Hold on a second. Whether it's to reconcile, whether it's to take your last, to say farewell to them, whether it's to visit them because they're sick, whatever it is, it wouldn't be surprising if they came for reasons having nothing to do with learning Torah. What's interesting is that their answer to him is, we've come to learn Torah. Right? Now, it could be that that is why they've come, as Lily said, but it's also perfectly possible that that's not actually why they've come, which would raise the question of, why do they say that is why they've come? Right? They could have said, well, we've come to visit you because you're not feeling well. They could have said all sorts of things. It strikes me that as soon as he says, why did you come? I'm working now with the premise that they haven't come to learn Torah, that they've come for one of the other reasons. But as soon as he says, why have you come? So the only thing they can possibly say that would make sense in the context of this relationship, that would make sense to him, is we've come to learn Torah. They might have other motivations. You're a rabbi, we haven't seen you in a while, you're sick, this is a magical thing to do. Reconciliation, all these sorts of things, but what would make sense to him in their minds is we've come to learn Torah, because for him, right, that's what it's all about. Right? The thing he's talking about is not, I've missed you, how come you're still mad at me, couldn't we make up? Right? The thing that's on his mind is, I have this Torah. To not have come to me before means you haven't had access to my Torah. So, I don't know how I got onto that just now. But anyway, back in the fourth paragraph, now that they are, right, now that they've decided, oh my God, I said, why are they asking him all these questions now? So, some of you said, right, it's because he's just chastised them for not asking him these questions. And they say, oh my gosh, you know, you're kind of right. All of this Torah is about to leave us. We've got to sort of make up for lost time. We've got to take the last few minutes and get whatever Torah we can. And somebody else said, well, maybe it's because once they've said, we've come to learn Torah, they have to actually now make that real. Like, it sort of jogs in their mind, oh my goodness. Well, when we've come to visit Rabbi Eliezer, what else will we be doing other than learning Torah from him? In any event, there's this kind of rush that you see at the beginning of the fourth paragraph, right? You know, if you sort of read it aloud, you get that sense of this kind of snowballing of questions. HaKadur v'hayimus v'akamir tzor ha-magoliyot mashkol tana mahu. The narrator doesn't even say Amrulo. It sort of kind of snowballs on, right? And he says Hutahor. Now, I want to spend a second on the case of Min Alsh Al Gabe Ha'imus, and for this I'm going to give a hint. Don't get scared by how many words, underlines, bold, and other kinds of things there are on this piece of paper. Okay? Let's see how quickly we can get this around. So I was saying before, right, that if you imagine this as a scene in a movie, at the beginning of this paragraph, the music would be getting louder because we hear them asking questions on the very same topic that led to this disastrous situation to start with. What I want to point out is that when we get to the final question that he answers about the shoe on the left, that within rabbinic tradition, that question appears in a different text, in an earlier text, which I think would be sort of in the minds of the audience who would be hearing this story. And for those who already have the handout, this is on the, there's two sides of the handout. One has all the rectangles and stuff. That's the side you should be on. Okay. In the bottom rectangle, you can see three texts. The first one from Mishnah Kelim, the second one from Tosefta Kelim. My Kelim is a very long tractate. It's 30 prakim long. What other tractate is 30 prakim long? Full-time yeshiva students? I can't hear. That's true. I'm not sure that what you mean to be saying is correct, but what you're saying is correct.
The Babas.
Yes, the Babas used to be Nazik, exactly, right? The three Bavot, right, are three sections. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Our three sections of Masechet that used to be called Masechet Nezikin, which is in Seder Nezikin, is like New York, New York. Okay, we no longer have Masechet Nezikin because each of those bavot, each of those sections, has sort of transformed into its own Masechet, and probably because, you know, bindings could not possibly hold Baba Kama, Baba Batra, and Baba Metzia together, especially in the Oz V'Hadar edition. It would be like this. And okay, but Masechet Kelim also is a 30-chapter Masechet. And it too sometimes is seen as, you know, sort of for convenience sake, consisting of three bavot, the third one being Bava Batra, the third one. So that's why where it says Tosefta Kelim in the bottom rectangle, it says Tosefta Masechet Kelim Bava Batra. It doesn't mean our Bava Batra, it means the third part, meaning Hakim 21 to 30. Okay? So that was all relevant, just wanted to test your knowledge of these things. Okay, so you can see that the first two texts are from Mishnah Kelim and Tosefta Kelim. We'll read the one from Mishnah Kelim. It says, Min al sha'al ha'emum. Sometimes the word last is written emus and sometimes emum, which makes sense in written form. That can translate to sense in oral form. But anyway, Eshu on the last, Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitam'im. Okay, so this relates to a question that I think Itamar asked before. In fact, we do have a tradition about this particular law, that there is a machloket between Rabbi Eliezer and Chachamim, and the position that he takes here in this Mishnah is the position that's reflected in his statement, Utahol. Same thing in Tosefta Kelim, Min al ha'imus, Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitamim. Same thing. Now, this law also appears in a third Tanaitic source, and this is in the Tosefta of Tractate Beidio. And this is the source which I think is critical to the story. The source begins by saying, Arba'at Dvarim Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitam'im. There are four things, that Rabbi Eliezer declares pure, and that the sages declare impure. And then I'm skipping the first two. The third one is, Min ol al ha'imum, a shu on the last, Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitam'im. The fourth one, chitchol chuliot v'natan chol bein chulia l'chulia. If you take an oven and you break it in, you cut it into layers, and you put sand between one layer and the next, what is this oven? Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitamim. Rabbi Eliezer declares it pure, and the sages declare it impure. This is the oven. Right? This is the oven, which is the subject of dispute in that Tanur Shel Achnai story, which leads to Rabbi Eliezer's excommunication when he says, Tahor. Okay? So, min ol, the case of the shu on the last, is the third of four famous cases that Rabbi Eliezer and Chachamim disputed, that Rabbi Eliezer said was Tahor. The very next case in the rabbinic tradition, remember, it's an oral tradition, people have this source in their mind. When you hear the question, the shoe on the last, what do you say about the shoe on the last, Rabbi Ezra? Oh, he says Tahor. The music gets really loud because you know that the next question that they would be asking, right, is, well, what about this oven? And when he said Tahor about this oven in the past, that's what led to the neder, right? That's what led to the excommunication, which is what set up the tragic events that we are looking at in this story now. So let's read this again. Chitchol chuliyot v'natan chol bein chuliyah l'chuliyah. Rabbi Eliezer mitaher v'chachamim mitam'im. Rabbi Eliezer declares pure. Chachamim declare impure. V'hayat nikot tanur shel achnai. And this oven was called tanur shel achnai. She'alav rabu machlokot b'Yisrael. Right? Concerning which many disputes, or more likely divisions, divisiveness, much divisiveness arose in Israel. That phrase is adopted in the Bavli story of Tanur Shel Achnai, right? Where later on in the story, after Eliezer is excommunicated, those who know the whole story will recall that Rabbi Gamliel is traveling on a ship, and there's a kind of a tsunami, and a big wave is about to overturn the ship. And Rabbi Gamliel stands up and he says, hey God, don't do this to me. You should know I didn't do this for my honor or for the honor of my dynasty, right? He's a patriarch, but rather I did it for your honor, shelo yarbu machlokot b'Yisrael, right? To make sure that this kind of divisiveness not proliferate in Israel. Okay? So this line from Tosefta Adiot, right, is a line were these last two lines, right, are the two lines on which the story of Tanur Shalachnai, as we are familiar with it, is an expansion, right? And the question about the shoe on the last, right, is the question which immediately precedes the question, right, which leads up to, right, the devastation that occurs in that story. Okay? So let's turn back to our story for a second. And let's sort of keep this in the background, and I want to read this second last paragraph in our story again. They come to him, and they say, what's the law about these five objects? And he says, well, they're impure, but they can become purified just as they are. And they say, okay, that's great. Now, what about the shoe on the last? And he says, it's tahor. And in your mind, what's resonating is, right, the next, very next question would be, right, if he lived another 15 seconds, what about this oven? Now, let me ask you a question. Let's say Rabbi Eliezer at that point would say, you know what, we've been arguing for 30 years, enough already, I believe in consensus, don't want to fragment community, I'll just give in. Okay? Right? So what would he say? He would say, Tameh. Right? And if he said Tameh, then what would happen? Yatza nishmato be Tuma. So what's interesting here, right, if you keep these sources in the background, so Vlashi's insight in the background, just give me 1 second, is that when we say he's Tameh, but he becomes pure just as he is, that's actually true to the plot of the story. Right? His death in purity, right, in purity, right, in a state of purity, is a sort of a confirmation an affirmation, right, of him actually staying exactly who he is. Right? It's the very fact that he sticks to his opinion, which at the same time was what made him Tameh, right, made this community of sages not be able to include him, and yet at the same time, retrospectively enables them to declare Yatza Nishvato B'Tahara, Hutara Nebim. So there's a kind of a paradox that this story is picking up. Okay, I'll continue with that in a second. Question? Rebecca? Or comment? Okay. So, what I want to do now is take a look at what these actual cases are. Right? The first five cases. Yes, go ahead.
So just, when they come to him and say, we have to learn Torah, and when they, you know, they respond to his next question, is it sort of like now we're ready to accept these type of things?
You know, it's hard to say, right? Josh is referring to the fifth line of the second paragraph. Really, you've come to learn Torah, then why haven't you come until now? You know, had they said what Benji said, well, we've come to do Bikur Cholin, or we've come to say our farewells, or one of the other, you know, we've come, one of the other things, then he wouldn't say, why haven't you come till now? Answer, well, you haven't been dying, right? But the fact that we say, which might be said just to assuage his feelings, maybe they don't want to talk about his impending death, we don't know, right? But the fact that they say we've come to learn Torah is what enables him to attack them. Really? Oh, really? You think that I'm somebody worth learning Torah from? So where have you been the last 30 years? And their answer, lo hayala nuknai, the way I've always read it, but there's certainly, you know, possibilities of other ways to read it, is just as a kind of, what do you say at that point? You know, he's got them, right? Because if in fact they're claiming that that's why they've come, then why haven't they come till now? And what's always the answer? Oh, you call your grandma, right? She says, oh, I haven't heard from you, you know, in 2 months, actually 2 months and 3 days, you know, what do you say? Right. I've been busy, and what does that say to her? Yeah, oh, too busy to call grandma, right? It wasn't mean you've been busy. Well, busy, right? But I mean, you've been too busy to do that. So that's how I've always read it, but maybe I'm being a little too contemporary about that. But it feels to me like at that point they're stuck. There's nothing they can say that would get them out of this. And we've been learning with a better teacher. I mean, what are they going to say? Once they put in terms of Torah, and he sees himself, which doesn't seem to be disputed here, as the receptacle of Torah, then what can you say about why haven't you come till now? So you make, you know, the dumbest possible excuse, which is a kind of a vacant statement. You know, I was too busy, I didn't have time, I didn't get to it. You know, it was on my calendar, but I didn't get to it. It's a non-statement. It's really saying, I don't have a good answer, grandma. And that's how I read it, but obviously there's other ways you can read it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think I missed this when you mentioned it before, but you are allowed to study with someone who is in Kari?
Not Kari. Excommunication.
Yeah, Kari.
Right. Nidui. Yeah. Interesting, an interesting idea. Right? Okay, so what I want to do is take a minute to look at these five cases, right? The case of the ball and the last and the amulet and the bundle of pearls and the small weight. What are those things? Right? What are those things and what is the halakhic question? So Rashi tells us what they are. And I'll read you, it's part of the same Rashi I was reading before. And again, apologies that I didn't give it to you. Rashi says, Lefi shekli or ein mekabel tuma ela im ken yesh lo beit kibur. He says because an object made of ore, of skins, leather, a leather object, is not susceptible to impurity unless it has what's called a beit kibur. It's a beit kibur unless it's shaped as a receptacle, unless it literally has an inner shape that's a receptacle. V'hani, and these objects, ho'il v'kibulan na'aseit l'malotan, malori b'tocho olamit, lo shmei kibul. The best way I think about this, and I know you're all going to correct me about, I'm going to make seven mistakes when I'm about to say this, but so just don't bother, it's not going to help, I've been corrected before, but imagine a football, okay? So it's leather, right? Pigskin or something, yeah? It's made of leather, okay? And there's stuff in it, and it's like sewn up. Am I good? Okay. So that's what these things are. A ball, for example. A last, which was a form made of leather that's stuffed with something and closed up. An amulet, like a leather pendant or whatever with maybe some little thing inside, something like that, okay? So these things, he says, Rashi says, this is the question. In general, a leather thing that's a receptacle, right? Is what is the characteristic that enables it to be susceptible to impurity. But these things, right, their receptacleness, right, is made to be filled on a permanent basis. And therefore, the question that they're asking is this considered a kli? Is this considered a vessel? Right? Is this considered a receptacle such that it is susceptible to tuma? Or is it not considered a receptacle because, after all, it was once open and you put stuff in it, but now it's closed up and that stuff is never going to come out? Does everybody understand just what happened? Okay. So to me, right, this is a very interesting image for Rabbi Eliezer himself. If you think of the way Rabbi Eliezer describes himself in that central paragraph, right, the long speech that he says after the initial conversation with his students, right, he takes his two arms and he rests them on his heart, and he says, "Woe to you, my two arms, which are like two sifrei Torah that are rolled up." Mm. And in addition to that, right, remember, and somebody asked us before, the opening image in the story, the opening object, right, the first object that we hear about in the story, right, is the tefillin. And to fill in that Hyrcanus, really, the son wants to remove from him, and he refuses to allow Hyrcanus to remove. Now, what is tefillin other than, right, a leather receptacle with Torah inside, with little rolled up Torah scrolls inside? And when the Eliezer bemoans, right, the Torah that nobody is going to manage to take from him, right, it says he takes his arms and he puts them on his heart, which might also be a kind of a tefillin image. But what he's saying is, my body is like a Sefer Torah that's rolled up. I have this Torah rolled up inside of me, and it's never going to be taken out. Nobody's ever going to be able to access it. And it strikes me that the kadur and the imus, right, these objects, which as Rashi explains, are objects made of skin with something inside of them. And the question is, do we consider that a receptacle if it has received? And the word kibul or kabbalah is a word not only for an object being received, but also a word for traditions, Torah traditions being received, right? Moshe kibel Torah misinai, kach kibalti merabotai, right? Rabbi Eliezer is somebody who has received Torah, but sees himself as somebody who is sewn up,
nobody can actually access that Torah. Just hold on one second. So I think want to suggest, and you know, take this or leave this, but I want to suggest that the very images that they're asking about, do we consider these things to be kelim or not? His answer is yes, by the way. Right? From the fact that they're tmeim, right, that they're susceptible to tumah, means that we do consider them to be kelim. It's a flawed kind of kli. It doesn't mean to be a kli that, you know, it's like, you know, somebody gives you a box of candy that is sealed so that you can never open it. I mean, what does it mean to have a kli, right, a receptacle that can take things in and not take things out? So I think that that's a kind of a core image of the story that fits in with the tefillin, that fits in with this image of being a sort of rolled up, permanently rolled up Sefer Torah, and the notion that he's on one, on the one hand, this kind of the ultimate kli of Torah, the ultimate receptacle of Torah, but on the other hand, that Torah cannot be accessed by anybody, right, is again the kind of the tragic paradox of this story. It's not that they say to him, we don't care about your Torah, who cares about your Torah, your Torah is trivial, your Torah is... It doesn't seem... They at the end of the day, would want to have access to that Torah. That's what Rabbi Akiva is bemoaning at the end in some weird way. It's not exactly clear the metaphor he's saying, but I need you in order to access Torah. And yet, right, and yet I haven't been able to do that. Let me pause for a second and see if there's a couple of questions, and then we'll go on just a little bit. Yes?
Why would... that the Rabbi Eliezer shouts out to his son and his wife that he wants his tefillin still on and be the thing that signifies to the visitors that he is still seen. In other words, if what you're saying is correct, namely that he wants these things wrapped on him and to say they can never be taken out of me, so to speak. You know, that should symbolize to the rest of them that he will never change.
Right. I think that's a very important point. In other words, at the beginning of the second paragraph, when it says, when they see that the atom miyushevet alav, right? When they see that his mind is settled upon him, meaning that he's sane, it doesn't mean they see that he's nice. Hold on a second. In fact, right, if you were Rabbi Eliezer's son and all of a sudden he would say, oh, hi, son, you know, how was your day? You'd say, the guy's gone crazy, right? In other words, that Tomi Yishevet Alav doesn't mean, right? I mean, again, I think that's the point of the story. He's exactly the guy he is. The fact that he's yelling at his wife and son, right, and the fact that also he gives a cogent explanation for why he thinks this was a bad move on his son's part, it shows that. Doesn't show that he's lovely, warm. It's not warm, fuzzy. Yishevet Alav. It just means he's not insane. Okay. And now, by the way, I mean this whole thing of taking off the tefillin erev Shabbat as a kind of a side point. There's other interesting aspects to that besides, you know, what I'm suggesting is this kind of image of tefillin as a kind of a sefer Torah, as a religion himself, which is again, the story begins with erev Shabbat and it ends with Motzei Shabbat. The story begins with an encounter between Rabbi Eliezer and his son, and ends with an encounter between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva, who has described himself as his spiritual son. Avi, he calls him my father. Right? So there's a kind of a parallel between the beginning and the end of the story in terms of Erev Shabbat, Motzei Shabbat, two kinds of sons, and the issue of taking off the tefillin might have other resonances there. In other words, it's not only, I think, that Rabbi Eliezer doesn't want him to take off tefillin because tefillin is kind of something he's so attached to. He is, in a sense, tefillin. But there's other, I think, elements of tefillin here. One of which is, and this is pointed out to me by a couple of friends of mine, that the story begins really at a kind of a liminal moment. This is a kind of, those few minutes before Shabbat, it's almost getting dark. It's that borderline between Chol and Shabbat. For Rabbi Eliezer, it's the borderline between life and death. And taking off the tefillin here might be experienced by Rabbi Eliezer, but certainly could be experienced by us, the reader, as also taking off his tefillin because he's about to die. In fact, in a parallel that you have on the other hand that I gave you, in the Yerushalmi parallel, at the very top of the page, the page without all the rectangles, in the very last line of that first paragraph, in the Yerushalmi story, after he dies, Rabbi Yeshua goes in and takes off his tefillin. We have this also, if anybody's familiar with the story about Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi and Shibot Kuf Gimel, the death of Yudhas. He's very, very sick. He actually has intestinal problems, so he has to constantly go to the bathroom. And his maidservant sees it, that he's in so much pain, and so she arranges that the students stop praying for him so that he can die. Okay, but in that story, what does it say? What does she see? What does she notice that makes her realize how very sick he is? She sees that he keeps taking his tefillin off. Now, he's taking them off to go to the bathroom, right? But taking them off also, taking them off, putting them on, is also a kind of emblematic of the fact that he's hovering between life and death. Mm-hmm. And she chooses to tip the scales there so that he can die. So it could be also that the taking off the tefillin is a kind of a sign of the liminality of this moment, both in terms of Chol and Shabbat, but also in terms of him hovering between life and death, and he doesn't want. You know, it's kind of like when I, as a kid, you know, I watched a lot of movies on TV, and most of which I didn't understand at all, but, you know, you always had the priest coming in and doing last rites. I used to wonder about that as a kid. Now, of course, we do something similar, but I didn't see that in movies, right? And it was struck me, like, you know, they called the priest, well, in those days, you know, this was ancient history when I was a kid, you know, people didn't, like, talk about, like, you didn't tell somebody they were dying. That was a different era, right? So, you know, but then you call the priest in, so, you know, what does that say? So there's something, perhaps, here also about Rabbi Yehuda reacting to, you know, this moment of, you know, liminality, or this, you know, I don't want to be transitioned out yet, or something. Or at least we might read it that way, whether or not that's nice. So anyway, that's a kind of side thing. Okay, let me, I want to point out a couple of other things about this story. Remember, right, that this story, within the context of the page that it's on, right, is actually, you know, it looms large because it's a big story and because it takes up a lot of space. But in the context of the Talmudic argument, it actually is a snippet, right? The Talmudic argument, if we just wanted to summarize it, is like this. Mishnah says that Rabbi Akiva transmitted a teaching about planting cucumbers in the name of Rabbi Yehoshua. But our story says that Rabbi Akiva learned it from Rabbi Eliezer. That's all the story is about in the context of the argument. So I want to look at the argument for a second, and I want to sort of bring the framework of the argument right back into the story. In other words, I want to erase the rectangle that I put here. And not look at the story just in itself, but now look at the story as a part of this longer discussion. So how does the Gemara answer this question? Now the Gemara says, wait a minute, how come in the Mishnah Rabbi Akiva transmits this teaching in the name of Rabbi Yehoshua when this story tells us that he learned it from Rabbi Eliezer? So in the line under, below the rectangle, it says, Alma, Alma, guys. This implies that may Rabbi Eliezer Gemara, that actually he didn't learn this teaching from Rabbi Yehoshua, rather he learned it from Rabbi Eliezer. So what about that? The Gemara answers, Gemara me Rabbi Eliezer, velo sevara. Hada Gemara me Rabbi Yehoshua, ve'azgura nihale. Well, it's true that he Gemara, that he learned it in the sense of to receive a teaching, right? He received the teaching from Rabbi Eliezer, v'lo sivara, but he didn't understand it. Hada Gemara Rabbi Yehoshua, so then at a later point in time, he received it from Rabbi Yehoshua, v'azbirat nihale, and Rabbi Yehoshua was able to make Rabbi Akiva understand. Now this strikes me as really sort of underscoring the tragedy of the story. Because in the story, in that middle section where Rabbi Eliezer is bemoaning the fact that, you know, here I am, what do? I teach Torah, and yet nobody's come to learn from me. And he says, but there was only one time, that one guy asked me something. It was Akiva, you know, and he asked me this thing about cucumbers, and I taught it to him. And then in the outer frame of the story, right, the Gemara says, actually, he couldn't learn it from Rabbi Eliezer. He heard it from him, but he couldn't really learn it from him. He needed to learn it from somebody else who could teach it to him in a different way. And I think what this frame brings into the story is not so much a new dimension, but really underscores the sort of tragic dimension of the story, which is that this same person, this Rabbi Eliezer, is on the one hand, right, recognized by everybody. It's not just his self-delusion, right? He's recognized by everybody, by Yeshua, by Rabbi Akiva, by everybody, right? As the embodiment of Torah. He is Torah. His very body is Torah, right? He is a receptacle full of Torah, and yet this Torah is not accessible to other people. And he can't teach Torah in the way that other people can receive. And in a way, I think what the story is talking about is really two different models of Talmud Torah, two different understandings of what Torah is, how Torah is learned, how Torah grows, how Torah lives within us and within community. And the model, I'll talk about what those two models are in a second, but what has to be understood is that the model that our rabbinic tradition in general, and the Bavli in particular, celebrates, that model is the model of Rabbi Akiva. It is not the model of Rabbi Eliezer. And so in a way, you know, as this story is kind of, you know, burying Rabbi Eliezer, sort of, you know, saying that that is our past, right? That is something that we value, but it's not actually the Torah that we can learn. It's not the Torah that we understand. It's not the Torah that represents the Torah of our future. Let me point to one thing in the story, which I think really emphasizes that as well, and it's that kind of odd set of metaphors that Rabbi Eliezer gives about how much Torah he got from his teachers and how much Torah his students got from him. And as we saw before, this begins in the third line of that middle paragraph, but I have learned a lot of Torah, I have taught a lot of Torah, I've learned a lot of Torah, but I did not chisarti, take away from or diminish from my teachers, even as much as a dog lapping up water from the sea. I have taught a lot of Torah, but my students have not chisruni, have not diminished me, except the amount of a mascara brush and a mascara tube. Now what's striking to me about this is the word chisarti. Chisarti, right? The chaser doesn't mean to take away, just mean in the sense of to take. It means to diminish. And what strikes me is that the model that Rabbi Eliezer has is that somehow the student diminishes the teacher's Torah. Now let me highlight that for a second. The second handout that I gave out in the non-rectangle written page, right, the cleaner page. If you look at the bottom text of the page, here's a parallel text from Shir HaShirim Rava. And it says the following thing. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shua, Rabbi Akiva. Each of those three gentlemen says. Rabbi Eliezer said, "Yin yiyu kol hayamim dio v'avamim kumusim v'shamayim v'eretz megilot v'chol b'nei ha'adam lav larim." Right? If all of the oceans would be full of ink, and all of the wetlands, maybe places where these reeds grow, and all of those things would be quills, and the heavens and the earth would be parchment, and all human beings would be scribes. Nevertheless, in maspikim l'chtov Torah she'lamadati, they would not be able to write down all of the Torah that I have learned. And v'ani lo chisarti ala ke adam shematbil zichuto kimikol bayam. Might be a little bit different, but I'll give a rough translation. They would not be able to write all the Torah that I've learned, and yet, right, I did not diminish it, the same word, right, I did not diminish it, except like a person who dips a mascara brush in the ocean. Now notice the mascara brush in the ocean are the two extremes of the two metaphors we had before, right, because the biggest receptacle in the two metaphors was the ocean, and the smallest thing that takes out, right, is a mascara brush. Right? The only thing I've been able to do is like a mascara brush in the ocean, and again, the language he uses is l'chaser, to diminish. Now, if you skip the next paragraph and go to the third paragraph, Rabbi Akiva says, "Ani ein bikoch lomar kamo she'amru rabotai." I don't have the power to say what my teachers have said. Ela rabotai chisruha v'ani lo chisarti. Rather, my masters can talk about diminishing, but I do not, right? I have not diminished it. Ella kimeriach ve'etrog. Hameriach nehaneh v'ha'etrog lo chaser. Uchimamalei me'amat ha'mayim uchimadlik miner liner. Right? He gives three metaphors. One is smelling an etrog, right? The smeller gets the hana'ah, gets the pleasure, gets the benefit of smelling the etrog. But the etrog is not chaser, the etrog is not diminished. Or, like somebody who fills up a jug, from a stream of water, right? You get water, but the stream keeps flowing. Or like somebody who lights a candle from another candle, right? You now have a light, right? And the original candle is still lit. And what strikes me here is that what Shir HaShirim Rabbah is picking up on is this language of L'chaser, that for Rabbi Eliezer, there's kind of there's several things about L'chaser. One is there's almost an antagonistic relationship between students and teachers, right? That rather than this kind of complimenting the teacher with me, right, the student is in some way, it's a kind of a zero-sum game. You get my learning, I have less learning, which is kind of a strange notion. There's some sort of almost belligerence there, which I think we see manifested in our story with this kind of anger towards the student. But the other thing about this is that l'chaser means it's a quantitative metaphor. Right? Rabbi Eliezer's understanding of Torah is a quantitative thing. There's an amount of Torah out there. What is that amount of Torah out there? Where does it come from? Yeah, it's the Torah that's received in tradition. And throughout the Talmud and other rabbinic texts, Rabbi Eliezer is associated with, right, in Pirkei Avot, what is Rabbi Eliezer? Remember Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai gives metaphors to inform his students?
The cistern that doesn't lose a drop?
It's the plastered cistern that doesn't lose a drop. Not the Mayan Hamid Gaber, right? The overflowing spring, right? It's the plastered cistern that doesn't lose a drop. Okay? He's the person who always says, whether or not this is exactly, literally accurate, that where he says, I've never taught a teaching that I didn't receive from my masters. Right? He is the Baal Kabbalah, not Kabbalah, but Kabbalah. Right? He is the master of reception, right? He sees Torah as that which you receive. And when you have a quantitative metaphor, right, if Torah is a quantity, right, then it can actually only ever be lost. And it can never be replenished. It can only diminish. Which is why in the two metaphors that he gives in our story, right, we start out with an ocean. By the time he gets to it, it's just a mascara brush full. And it's a quantitative metaphor. Rabbi Akiva, when he says, in the text we just read, when he says, I can't say what my master said, right, he's not just saying, oh, you know, I took even less from my teachers than he took from his teachers. What he's saying is, I have a different metaphor. Right? I don't talk about diminishing Torah, right? I talk about Torah growing. Right? If your understanding of Torah is not as Torah as received tradition, right, but Torah that sort of grows as each person participates in it, then it's not just that you don't diminish Torah by taking from your teachers, it's not just that Torah isn't lost from generation to generation, but actually you grow Torah by learning from your teachers, and actually Torah grows from generation to generation. So what I want to point out, sort of going back to our story, and fitting in with what we were saying before about this frame, right, where the Gemara sort of solves the contradiction that it sees by saying that Rabbi Akiva received a tradition from Rabbi Eliezer but could not comprehend it. He had to receive it from somebody else who was able to explain it to him. Right, that what this is pointing to is this real difference in conceptions of Torah. And I think, you know, what one of the things this story is about, one of the things it's about is it's just a very rich and complex human story. These are real people, by which I don't mean they have biographies, by which I mean, hold on a second, by which I mean they're people we know. When we learn about them, we come to know them, and the more we meet these people in our studies, these are people we come to know. So in that sense, they're real human people, and this is a story about a flawed and a tragic relationship. But at the same time, it's a story about conceptions of Torah. And as I said before, it is certainly the Rabbi Akiva conception of Torah. What's Rabbi Akiva known for? He's Doresh Tilin, Tilin Shal Halachot, right? On every jot and tittle of every letter in the Torah, right? He is able to be Doresh, right? He makes new Torah all the time. It's the opposite model of the Rabbi Eliezer model. And ultimately, as I said before, that is the model that our rabbinic texts truly celebrate. I mean, that's the model of the rabbinic future. We see the story as a story about a sort of crossroads. Right? It's the end of the kind of Torah that Rabbi Eliezer represents. That kind of Torah actually has to end. Right? Because once you get down to the mascara body and the mascara tube, right, it's self-diminishing model is both. And ultimately, that model is replaced within our tradition, or our tradition sees itself replaced in that model with a model of Torah that has to be understood, which means not only have to explain it to me technically, but it has to live within me in a way that it makes sense to my experience, which means it's new Torah. When I learn Torah from somebody in a way that becomes mine, it becomes new Torah. I add to that Torah. It lives in a new way. And in a certain way, I think this story is a story. It's not about a rejection of Rabbi Eliezer in the fullest sense of that term. Right? The story ends with Rabbi Akiva saying, I need this guy. Right? Without this guy, I actually don't have Torah. Right? And I will miss this guy. Right? Because without him, there's parts of Torah I will never actually be able to access. And maybe I could never even have started learning Torah without this person. On the other hand, right, it's not from this person that I truly see my Torah as being generated. So to me, it's kind of a story about mourning a past, which is the foundation for the future that you need to live. And sort of how you can live a Torah, which at the same time draws from a Torah that you cannot live. That Rabbi Akiva, and ultimately in our tradition, is saying there is a Torah that we love, a Torah that inspired us, a Torah that represents the Torah of our teachers, and there's the Torah that we have to live, and always the Torah that we live is going to be different from the Torah of our teachers, by definition, because we are different people, we live in a different time. And how we can, at the same time, kind of celebrate and mourn the Torah of our teachers, and recognize that our Torah stands on the basis of our Torah, at the same time that we understand that our Torah has to live anew and grow through us. So, thoughts to leave you with. And if people have questions, I'm up here, but I also know that the mitzvah of the moment for the short-term people is to fill out the evaluations, and for the long-term people is to break down the room. But if while you're doing that, if you have questions or comments, I'm here.
Grab basic stuff of yours that's off the table. Take a computer item. You have one downstairs. The rest of us in different states.
Can I ask your fellows to keep an eye out for my black binder that's the one that we all have?